W1590 AM Denmark, W250 CV Green Bay, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Faith Abube. A juror speaking exclusively to ABC News after the conviction of disbarred attorney Alec Murdoch in South Carolina for the murder of his wife and son. Craig Moyer telling ABC's Eva Pilgrim most of the jury felt Murdoch was guilty right off the bat.
It was two not guilty, one not sure, and nine guilty.
What was your vote?
Guilty.
From the start?
Yes.
Suspected tornadoes in Louisiana and Texas, toppling trees and damaging property.
Of course, my grandbabies were crying. They're four and five.
Shirley Carden says she just got her grandchildren home from school when the roaring started. This is ABC News. President Biden this morning will award the Medal of Honor to retired Army Colonel Paris Davis. He was an African-American who fought in Vietnam. He's being recognized for his accomplishments on the battlefield.
You feel pleased that you served your country in the way that you thought you would serve your country. America becomes profoundly your flag that you carry around.
Davis was 26 years old and a captain when he and his team held off the enemy for 18 hours. Today's honor, long overdue. Davis was told the U.S. Army lost his paperwork twice. Congress is zeroing in on George Santos, the House Republican, now the subject of an ethics investigation into lies about his background and his finances. A separate subcommittee formed because of the sheer number of allegations. Santos says he will cooperate with the investigation. Today is the global day of unplugging, challenging you to turn off your phone and go screen-free for 24 hours. The idea? To stress the importance of taking a break from all our digital devices. Faith Abube, ABC News.
The Civic Media Network of radio stations across Wisconsin. We are your hometown radio, refreshed.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. Hearings are underway on the 2023 Farm Bill. A Senate hearing on Wednesday focused on preserving wildlife and climate. More from Eric Tigadoff.
According to defenders of wildlife, more than 70% of species listed under the Endangered Species Act rely on private lands. More than 40% of private land in the lower 48 states is managed for agriculture. The group's senior analyst for private lands, Mary Fafko, says the bill is an opportunity to combat the linked issues of biodiversity loss and climate change.
Farmers, ranchers, and producers play a critical role in conserving our nation's wildlife. With so many of our nation's imperiled species occurring on private lands, depending on private lands, they depend on this farm bill.
Fafko says defenders of wildlife's recommendations for the Farm Bill include incentivizing projects with co-benefits for climate and wildlife and providing national-level funding for all working lands for wildlife initiatives. Christine Ackland is the Northern Rockies senior attorney for the Center for Biological Diversity. She says the last Farm Bill also included exclusions for some timber sales from analyses on their environmental impact. She says taking away this exclusion would help protect diverse habitats.
That allows the public to be involved in that process to ensure that these projects aren't completely irreparably damaging important ecosystems across the country.
The current Farm Bill from 2018 expires on September 30th. I'm Eric Tegedoff. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
And this is Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
Five hours of special spring primary election coverage. A dozen reporters, hosts, and political experts tracking results for you around Wisconsin.
Everything from your local races to the Supreme Court.
Janet Protasiewicz and Dan Kelly moving on to the general election.
Coverage you won't find anywhere else. And we're doing it all again for the important general election in April.
Elections or anytime, we're here for you. Your local Civic Media radio station and streaming on the Civic Media app.
You've got questions about navigating the healthcare system? Kristen Lyerly helps us find answers and discusses other issues at the intersection of healthcare and politics. Hometown Health, Thursday mornings at 7:30 on Up North News Radio.
Go by any construction site in Wisconsin, you're going to see a lot of Michael's trucks. Since 2014, they've had more than $1 billion worth of contracts with the state government.
A large part of those coming with Foxconn without any results in that area.
Do we want a governor who might be giving his brothers the contract? I think he needs to answer that before the election.
We'll just kick that one down the road. We'll cross that bridge when we get to it. But of course, Michael's corporation would get to build that said bridge.
Listen Monday through Friday from 2 to 3. It's Dueling Tangents.
Don't you wish your life came with a warning app?
That dog does not want to be petted.
Well, life doesn't always give you time to change the outcome, but prediabetes does. Take the one-minute test today at doihaveprediabetes.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and its Prediabetes Awareness Partners.
This is Civic Media for the Fox Valley.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media. To learn more, go to our website, civicmedia.us.
Welcome. Grab your favorite morning beverage and join us for Morning Cannolis with Jim Santel. You don't know me, but I'm your brother. Sampling the news desserts of the week, here is your host, Jim Santel.
Good morning. It is Saturday, March 4th. Here on Morning Cannolis, this is our weekend review, our analysis, our discussion of the most important stories in law, in government, and yes, the aspiration for justice in America. I thank you very much for joining me on this beautiful Saturday morning here in the state of Wisconsin, here in these United States of America. This is a production, as you all well know, of Civic Media. We're coming to you this morning from the studios of WAUK Radio in downtown Waukesha. That is the Shaw at 540 AM, 101 FM. And I am joined in the studios here by my ever faithful and productive and professional producer, Kelvin. And together today, we're going to be talking with you in a special program about the Supreme Court. This is the second in our Saturday morning series of three, chatting about the highest court in the land. We began this just last Saturday, continuing again this Saturday to talk to you again about those important stories coming out of our United States Supreme Court. Our agenda, as always, is going to be ambitious but achievable, I believe, but also informative and inspiring, hopefully. And we, as always, going to ask the questions, what happened? What are the facts? What do we know for certain? Why is it important? Why is it relevant? Why is it meaningful to us here in America? And what should we do about it? What can we do about it if indeed there needs to be some remedy out there? What is the action item to pursue? And that agenda, that very ambitious but achievable agenda, is also going to apply to us this morning as we talk once again about our United States Supreme Court, a bit of a hiatus from our other more traditional programs every Saturday morning. Today, again, focusing on what the nine justices of the Supreme Court in the early part of the 21st century are doing, their decisions, as they make their way through what is almost the halfway mark of this term of the United States Supreme Court. That's right, we're almost halfway through the 2022-2023 term. Began back on October 1, continues through November, December, January, and February, and now in early March, we're entering into the almost, not quite, the second period of major activity by the United States Supreme Court. We know in particular that coming in May and in June, maybe even in July, the United States Supreme Court is going to be issuing major decisions on a number of very significant cases in a number of different areas. We have talked about those in the past, and I promise you that come May and June, and perhaps into July as well, on this very broadcast, Calvin and I are going to be chatting with you about those decisions, talking about what they mean, why they're important, and again, what it is we should be doing about them, not only in response to them, but also as we go forward to figure out what they mean for America. And so this morning, as in the past, our program, our broadcast about the Supreme Court includes some introductory material about history, about traditions this morning of the court that are not necessarily in the public domain, some things a little bit about procedure, about tradition, and about practice by our highest court in the land, the highest federal court in our land that tells us,
as John Marshall told us way back in the early part of the 19th century, what the law is, how we to understand the Constitution, and how we are supposed to conduct ourselves pursuant to that Constitution and the things that the Supreme Court says and doesn't say about the world in which we live. We're going to talk also this morning about some very important things that happened just this past week, the news of the Supreme Court, and that includes a couple of cases that, yes, believe it or not, were decided, some opinions handed down by the court in areas that probably most of us are not directly involved in. We're going to mention those along the way, not spend a lot of analysis on those, but then also talking about a couple, actually three cases altogether that were argued this past week. At least one of those, maybe two of them, highly significant. And we'll chat about the reasons why that oral argument presented this past week before the Supreme Court is important and that we should all know about it. And then we're also going to be talking about one major case placed on the docket of the Supreme Court by the Supreme Court justices, not for review, not for argument, not for briefing this term, but going to take it up next term. That is the 2023-2024 term of the court, which means we're not going to get a decision on this particular issue until well over a year from now. Yet nonetheless, a very important case they decided to take up from a lower court, going to decide that in the next term as we go forward. In addition, beyond that, we're going to be spending some time at the start of our time together this morning talking about two major cases that define who we are and how we live. I promised as a part of this series, we're also going to be analyzing, taking a look at some of those major cases that do define what America is all about. And significantly, as we began at the end of the hour last week, we're talking about firearms and the all-important rulings of the Supreme Court in 2008. And again, just last year in June of 2022, that interpret and give us meaning, give us a sense of what they think the Second Amendment is all about. A case back in 2008, another one again just last year, that for the first time in American history, redefine what the Second Amendment is all about. We're going to talk about those cases right at the top of our hour today. And then we're going to go into those other areas involving court history and court news as well. And that, of course, also anticipates your involvement down the road on all these issues as we think more about the United States Supreme Court today and in the future. Let's begin, as I promised, with some talk about traditions. We chatted last time about some of the history of the court, when it first met, how it first met, some of the challenges at the time. For all of the changes in its history since the Supreme Court was put in place at the time of our nation's birth, the Supreme Court has actually retained many, many traditions. And in some respects, it is the same court that met way back in 1790, that first meeting way back in New York City, our nation's capital. It prompted one legal historian to call it the first court still sitting to this day. Indeed, a lot of traditions continue since those early days of the United States Supreme Court. Let's talk about some of those. The justices have perpetuated undeniably, a tradition of longevity in tenure. Many people, as we talked about last time, review the Supreme Court decisions and wonder out loud if indeed there should be time limits. We know from our discussion last week that in the Constitution itself, it establishes that Supreme Court members stay in place, do not leave, are not required to leave during their period of so-called good behavior. And that has been interpreted to mean that they can stay there throughout their lifetime. It's true of Supreme Court justices. It is true of appellate judges on all of our appellate courts throughout the United States of America. It is true also of our district court judges. You are appointed to a federal judiciary position, and the reality is that you can remain there for the rest of your life. That also means, of course, that the only ways that you are going to leave that position is to resign. And yes, indeed, we know that there are four justices, former Supreme Court justices, still many of them active out there promoting civics, promoting understanding of the law, understanding of what our Constitution says and does not say. Resignation is one option. The other one, of course, is impeachment. There has been one justice impeached but not removed by the United States Senate. That's also contemplated by the Constitution. And then, of course, as we all recognize, Supreme Court justices, because of some of their longevity, also die in office. And we have seen that recently with Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Justice Antonin Scalia, and others in our contemporary American history. But the reality, once again, is that there are an awful lot of justices who remain on the bench for a long period of time. Let's talk about some of that longevity right now. The record for length of service held by Justice William O. Douglas, a lion in the area of civil rights, human rights, and understanding about the notion of privacy, a privacy doctrine in the Constitution. He retired in 1975 following, get this, more than 36 years and 6 months on the court. Justice Stephen Field, justice you probably haven't heard a lot about, he holds the record for the second longest tenure, discharged the duties of being a justice for more than 34 years and 6 months. And then John Paul Stevens, who is a part of our contemporary jurisprudence, he retired fairly recently in 2010. He ranks just below Justice Field, and Justice John Paul Stevens was also our circuit court justice here in the Seventh Circuit, which again includes Wisconsin and Indiana and Illinois. John Paul Stevens represented us. He was our justice. And so when it came to petitions coming out of our three states, he was the one who did the first cut, the first review on them. He was our justice on the Supreme Court for that entire period of time. And then the record for the fourth longest period of service belongs to John Marshall, again, one of our early chief justices, making him the longest tenured chief justice in the court's history. Now, according to tradition and custom in our American courts, the nine justices, when you see photographs of them, a fairly famous photograph now since Ketanji Brown Jackson joined the court last summer, you will see as you pull up the not only articles about the Supreme Court, but if you go online and explore some things more about the Supreme Court, its history, its tradition, and yes, indeed, what it's reviewing right now, you will see a photograph of those nine Supreme Court justices. We've been doing that almost ever since photography has been a part of our lives. And the nine justices traditionally are seated by seniority on the bench. The chief, of course, occupies the center chair. The senior associate justice sits to his right, the second senior to his left, and so on and so on, alternating right and left by seniority. Since at least 1800, it's also been traditional for those justices, whether they're appearing in a photograph or appearing on the bench, whether they're entertaining arguments, sometimes reading their own opinions in cases decided, it's been always their tradition to wear black robes while in the court. Chief Justice Jay, who was the first Chief Justice, apparently establishing this for his colleagues, lent a fairly colorful air to the early sessions by wearing robes with a red facing, somewhat like those that were worn by the early colonial and English judges. And if you go to Washington, D.C. today, and you go into the American History Museum, you can see the robe that John Jay wore at that time. It's trimmed with red and white on the front and sleeves. It's now in possession of the Smithsonian Institution. Today, of course, most of our justices, all of the justices, have abandoned that flourish, if you will, established by John Jay, and instead gone to black robes. We know, of course, that many of the men on the court will wear ties. Many of the women also adorn their attire with something appropriate, but nonetheless celebrating the fact that they, too, are on the Supreme Court. Morning clothes were also a part of the attire worn by those who are appearing in front of the Supreme Court. When we come back after this, our first break, I'm going to tell you more about that tradition in the history of our United States Supreme Court. Stay with us for that and more on the High Court in America.
Hear that? If you own a business, that's a problem. What you really need is this. If you want to make your phone ring this spring, we have just the thing. Sponsor weather forecasts on your local Civic Media station. We've slashed prices on our premium weather sponsorships up to 50%. Tie your business message and phone number into our hourly weather forecasts and get results. But you must hurry.
This spectacular offer ends March 15th.
Log on to civicmedia.us/weather now. That's civicmedia.us/weather.
The radio show your mother warned you about.
Actual tyranny of a dictator. Dictator is going to dictate Putin. And what did Trump do? Trump kneeled to the man. embarrassing Republicans, and you're still with the guy? This is your front runner in 2024? You've been smoking some of Mike Lindell's crack. What are you thinking?
They're the GCCCP. We are the devil's advocates.
Live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6.
Uh-oh, Brad's buzzed.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, he's starting with the woots.
Woot,
good thing is, he knows when he's buzzed.
Know your buzzed warning signs? Call for a ride when it's time to go home. Buzz driving is drunk driving. A message from NHTSA and the Ad Council.
Join the conversation with your favorite hosts or shows anytime. Follow Civic Media on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Share your thoughts on our social media channels wherever you are, whenever you want. The Civic Media Network of local radio stations, here for you.
Here's your updated forecast. Cloudy skies expected this afternoon, with daytime highs approaching 45. Winds out of the west, 20 to 25 miles per hour. Lows level off around 23. Tonight, overcast skies. Overcast again tomorrow. Snow likely. Highs level off around 26. 2 to 4 inches of snow tomorrow through tomorrow night. For Civic Media, I'm meteorologist Paul Trombley on 98.3 FM and 1100 AM WISS. Right now, 38.
Civic Media for the Fox Valley.
And we are back. Thank you once again for joining me in this first hour, Saturday, March 4th, our weekly review, our analysis, our discussion of things like law and government and the aspiration for justice in America. This morning is the second of our three-part series focusing specially on the United States Supreme Court, its traditions, its history, and then spending some time talking about the ways in which the Supreme Court, yes, indeed, is in our news virtually every single week. Even not if in the top headlines, nonetheless, taking a center role in establishing who we are and how we live in America. And then also, we're going to be focusing virtually every single session as we go forward on two, if not more, major cases that have affected who we are and will continue to affect who we are. Those cases this morning involving firearms and American interpretation of the Second Amendment. Before we get into that very heavy but very important area of jurisprudence, let's go back to some of the traditions. Right before the break, I was talking about morning clothes, which was the tradition of most litigants as they appear in front of the Supreme Court to argue their cases, to present the reasons why their side should win, a tradition that you can still watch if you go to the United States Supreme Court on Capitol Hill, just directly east of the Capitol building. You can, in fact, now with the COVID crisis, at least in the court, somewhat abated. The Chief Justice has once again opened those up, those appellate arguments, for hearing, for reviewing, by seeing, by anyone who comes into the Supreme Court. You can stand in line and watch your court at work. And you will see today the vestiges of morning clothes from way back in the 1890s. A great story about this. It was always tradition for the attorneys, and again, regrettably, all male at the time, in the early years of the Supreme Court, until fairly recently, always wearing morning clothes, that is very formal clothing, to appear in front of the justices of the Supreme Court. And Senator George Wharton Pepper of Pennsylvania told friends of the incident he provoked when, as a very young lawyer in the 1890s, he was there, he was right before the Supreme Court to argue a case in so-called street clothes and not the more formal morning clothes. Justice Horace Gray, who was an associate justice at the time, was overheard whispering to a colleague, "Who is that beast who dares to come in here with a gray coat? Who is that beast who's come into our area, our presence here, without wearing morning clothes?" The young attorney, again, Pepper of Pennsylvania, was refused admission until he borrowed a morning coat. And of course, today, that tradition has gone away, with the notable exception of Department of Justice and other government lawyers, very proud to say, from the U.S. Department of Justice, who serve as advocates for the United States government. They still wear formal attire when they appear before the United States Supreme Court. What else has been the tradition for the court, which you can see once again as you go to Washington, D.C., and go into that building built in 1935 as the permanent now home of the Supreme Court? Well, quill pens have remained a part of the courtroom scene almost since the beginning as well. Quill pens are placed to this day on counsel table each day that the court sits, and it's been done again since the early days of the court. In addition, another tradition that continues, probably not seen, almost certainly not seen by us, but nonetheless a tradition called the judicial handshake. It's been a tradition since the days of Justice Melville Fuller in the late 19th century. And Fuller created this practice that when the justices assembled to go out on the bench before they appear publicly and go out there to hear the oral arguments each day, and also at the beginning of their private conferences, not a part of the public domain, at which they discuss decisions, make rulings, make findings, come to conclusions about how the cases will be resolved, who will write which opinion, who will dissent, who will concur, all those kinds of things. Before those conferences as well, again, inside the bowels of the Supreme Court building, each justice shakes hands with each of the others. And that includes, of course, the eight others that each justice would be in the companionship of. Justice Fuller instituted that practice as a reminder, he said, that differences of opinion on the court do not preclude, as he said, overall harmony of purpose. Well, that's been tested a lot recently, as you've had a lot of Supreme Court justices who have not been afraid to publicly comment on the conduct and especially the words, the finding of some of their colleagues. That has been done usually in fairly strong language by Supreme Court justices, often in dissents, criticizing majority opinions, sometimes in majority opinions, criticizing dissenting opinions, even sometimes in concurring opinions on the Supreme Court. Also, as we know, something we get to in the third of our series, Supreme Court justices have also been speaking publicly outside of the court itself. And sometimes in those settings, there's thinly veiled comments about the behavior and the conduct of their fellow justices. And so while they shake hands, it is not always reflective of the civility that may otherwise attend the Supreme Court. Finally, the Supreme Court has a traditional seal. Every part of government, as you know well, has a traditional seal. It's similar to the Great Seal of the United States, but it has a single star beneath the eagle's claws, and that symbolizes the Constitution's creation of one Supreme Court. One star, one Supreme Court on the traditional seal of the United States Supreme Court. That seal, the official seal, and yes, there's such a thing, is kept in the custody of the clerk of court and is stamped on all official papers. And that includes things like certificates given to attorneys who are newly admitted to practice and other official documents of the United States Supreme Court, a traditional seal that once again has been in place since the early years of our high court. It is the seal, this variation of it with this particular single star beneath the eagle's claws. It's a seal that's been in place for a long period of time, but nonetheless, it's been the fifth one in generations of seals that have preceded it. I encourage you, as I have said, to take part in the proceedings of the Supreme Court. Go there, and you will find out an awful lot more about the Supreme Court, including things like how many justices there are. Of course, we know that today that's nine. That has not always been the case. You'll find out more things about how the process actually works, what an oral argument actually looks like, how it is that the Supreme Court justices behave toward each other and question the litigants before them. You can hear all of that to this day on the website of the Supreme Court. Go there. You can hear about the oral arguments we're going to be talking about later on in this hour and the second hour here on Morning Cannolis. Stay with us for all of that commentary and more.
Thanks for listening to your local Civic Media radio station. Learn more on our website, civicmedia.us.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. No mercy today from the judge who sentenced Alec Murdaugh for the murders of his wife and son. Judge Clifton Newman giving Murdaugh two consecutive life sentences and then bringing up his own words.
Remind me of the expression you gave on the witness stand. Was it tangled?
What
tangle web we weave. What did you mean by that?
It meant when I lied, I continued to lie.
And the question is, when will it end?
Judge saying he believes Murdoch lied at his very sentencing when he doubled down that he had nothing to do with the murders.
I'm innocent. I would never hurt my wife, Maggie. And I would never hurt my son, Pawpaw.
Murdoch was led away in handcuffs in a prison jumpsuit to serve what the judge described as the rest of his natural life in prison. This is ABC News.
Aha! Leprechauns and Wisconsinites have a lot of things in common. We both look good in green. Chicks dig our accents.
You're cute.
And we all love what's on the other side of the rainbow. Get your pot of gold when you sponsor our hourly weather forecasts on your local civic media station.
That's 24 ads per day. One ad every hour right before the latest weather forecast.
And right now, the prices on these premium sponsorships are slashed up to 50%. But you must act before March 15th to take part. Log on to civicmedia.us/weather now. That's civicmedia.us/weather.
I was just curious as to why you called it the Paul Revere Show.
The Paul Revere Show is named this way because the poem that we all know, the famous ride, the poem was written to rally the troops to fight slavery and fight for democracy. And so I named the show the Paul Revere Show because I thought it was the time to get on the air and talk about democracy.
The Paul Revere Show with Mark Thompson. Listen Monday, 7 to 8 p.m., always on the Civic Media app.
Pat, I feel like all the women we have on our show, like our co-hosts, always get too famous for us. And then
I would just like to think that we are fertile ground from which they can blossom. We are the manure from which they spring.
The manure from which they spring. I was going to say holding fort, but I think your metaphor is way better.
Up North News Radio with Pat Krylo airs at its new time from 6 to 8 a.m. weekdays across Civic Media.
As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry.
My former boss, George Stanley, former editor of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. I've told you the story of that my brother and I are fighting over who's going to get our tickets. I think I have claim because I live here.
Exactly.
Right? He's older, but I live here.
Yeah, but that trumps it.
So. It's been decided now. It's done.
I'll tell my parents. That's even more.
You can let him go to one game if he wants.
Yeah, exactly.
As Goes Wisconsin with host Kristen Bry. Weekdays 11 to 2 on Civic Media and the Civic Media app. Earl Ingram.
I mean, for heaven's sakes, anybody who's heard Congresswoman Bobart from Colorado and Marjorie Taylor Greene and others, you just have to ask the question, if I'm a Republican, why would I continue to support that foolishness?
Asking the tough questions, searching for the answers we're all looking for. The Earl Ingram Show. Weekday mornings 8 to 11 on Civic Media and on the Civic Media app.
I'm looking at the phone lines. I'm seeing some familiar faces. What's in mind of Gina Beauclair?
Well, welcome back, Matt. I really miss you. We've been missing getting woke every morning, but now we'll get woke in the afternoon.
What's in mind of Andrew of Detroit?
Professor, it's so nice you're back. We missed you during your vacation, and I'm very happy to be in your class for the semester.
Thanks a lot for calling in. I appreciate all my callers.
Tune in to Matt Flynn Direct, Monday through Friday, 3 to 4 p.m.
Welcome back to our next segment, talking in this special session of our Saturday morning broadcast about, yes, the United States Supreme Court telling us virtually every single week these days what the law is, what it is not, interpreting the Constitution, sometimes addressing the legitimacy of executive orders, often addressing the legitimacy of congressional enactments, the legislation. We're going to talk about all of those kinds of things. And sure enough, today, as I promised at the end of our previous session last week, I'm going to spend some time in this hour talking about two major cases, hugely significant cases that have been issued by the Supreme Court in my lifetime, I suspect in the lifetime of many of you listening, having to do with firearms in America. At the end of our program last time, I began our discussion about this, identifying some of the concerns, the major, major challenges presented by firearms in America today. We all know well about the history and the contemporary use of guns in America. Depending upon which particular source you go to, in this year alone, in 2023, there have been somewhere between 70 and 80 mass shootings in America. What is a mass shooting? A mass shooting is any situation where four or more people involved in the incident are shot. Some of them may also be killed. That does not include the shooter himself or herself. 70 to 80 mass shootings in this country. We know, not too far from where we're broadcasting this morning, that even in this past week, in West Ellis, Wisconsin, we had a situation where a 12-year-old boy attending a birthday party in West Ellis at a tavern, joined by his 17-year-old friend, his name is Ronell Smith. The 12-year-old Ronell Smith was killed in Wisconsin at the receiving end of a firearm. His companion, his friend, a 17-year-old, the celebrant at the birthday party, was also injured but not killed. Those kinds of things, not necessarily a mass shooting, but those kinds of things continue to happen in America. They are no less tragic than those mass shootings that we hear about in the media all the time. And no one of reason, no one of traditional focus on humanity, civil rights, and our place among a community can look at our situation and say anything other than that. We need to do something about that. And at the end of this discussion this morning, we're going to talk about some of the things that the Supreme Court, even in the midst of its cases, which we're now going to talk about, has said are permissible. And the question then is, why don't we do them? If we know what works, why don't we do them? Hang on for that discussion as well. The Second Amendment itself, of course, again, passed by the first Congress, 1789, ratified by the states a couple of years later. What does it say? A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, comma, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Focus once again upon that notion of a well-regulated militia. Because, as I said last week, repeating it here again this morning, for over 200 years, the Second Amendment had not been interpreted by the courts, including federal courts, to vest a constitutional right in an individual to firearm ownership and use. That is a recent doctrine and happened in 2008. In fact, on four previous occasions, the United States Supreme Court had expressly rejected that notion, said that is not the case, expressly rejecting that construction, the application of the Second Amendment. And that changed in the case 2008 called District of Columbia versus Dick Heller. That case, again, coming out of the Supreme Court, finding in this landmark decision that the Second Amendment to the U.S. Constitution does, in fact, protect an individual's right to keep and bear arms unconnected with service in a militia, which is one of the lodestones, the corner of the Second Amendment, for traditionally lawful purposes like self-defense in the home. We'll get more to how we get to that spot right now. What happened in this case? Well, in February of 2003, six residents of the District of Columbia filed a lawsuit in the federal court in the nation's capital, and they challenged something called the Firearms Control Regulations Act of 1975 and said, that, you know what? We think that that particular law that basically prohibited the possession of firearms in the District of Columbia or required that rifles and shotguns and other firearms be kept unloaded or disassembled or bound by a trigger lock inside the homes, that prohibited the use, the possession of those guns or required that they be kept in that status, that is inconsistent with the Second Amendment. That was their position, again, butting up against 200 years of history. The lower court, a judge named Emmett Sullivan, who remains on the district court to this day, dismissed that lawsuit in March of 2004. And of course, they took it up. They do what Americans do, which is they took it up to the appeals court. That goes to the U.S. the circuit court in the District of Columbia circuit. And believe it or not, the district court reversed that dismissal in a 2-1 panel decision. The Court of Appeals struck down provisions of that D.C. law as unconstitutional. And eventually, this case comes to the United States Supreme Court, which brings us to the Heller matter. The defendants in that case petitioned the U.S. Supreme Court to hear the case. The Supreme Court said yes, granted what's called certiorari, sometimes called cert. Basically, we're going to review the legitimacy of this particular petition and determine whether or not it makes sense or not. And the question raised way back at that time in 2007, ultimately decided in 2008, was just this. Does this particular statute violate the Second Amendment rights of individuals who are not affiliated with any state-regulated militia, but who nonetheless want to keep handguns and other firearms for their own private use in their homes? That was the question presented to the United States Supreme Court way back in 2007. It represented, again, the first time since 1939 that the United States Supreme Court had addressed something even close to this, a case called U.S. versus Miller, again, finding, rejecting this notion that somehow there is a personal liberty, a personal right under the Second Amendment to possess and use firearms. Many, many amicus briefs, many, many other memorandums of law filed with the court. Supreme Court in this case heard these oral arguments in March of 2008, 15 years ago this month. And again, the transcripts of that are still available. You can take a look at those. And again, significantly, what was the decision? This changing the geography of America decision that comes out of the United States Supreme Court in 2008 says this: the Second Amendment does indeed protect an individual right to possess a firearm unconnected, disconnected with service in a militia. And also the Second Amendment protects the use of that firearm for traditional lawful purposes like self-defense in the home. That is a dramatic change from 200 years of history. And goes on to say, the Supreme Court does, that the amendment's prefatory clause that I just read announces a purpose but does not limit or expand the scope of the second part, which is the operative clause. And so pulls apart the law, pulls apart the text of the law, the Constitution itself, and stands it on its head and basically says, no, we have misinterpreted this for 200 years. The operative clause, text and history, demonstrate that it connotes an individual right to keep and bear arms. And this comes from the pen of what justice? Antonin Scalia. Justice Antonin Scalia wrote the majority opinion way back in 2008 and established, again, for the first time in our nation's history, what has now been bandied about far beyond its real focus and intent as a basic right to possess and use firearms. Note once again, the decision in Heller limited, even though it accomplishes this huge change, limited to possession and perhaps use of a firearm for traditional defensive purposes where inside the home, not in the public venues of America. Hold on to that concept. We can get back to that in just a minute. But like most rights, the Second Amendment right announced by Heller is not unlimited. And significantly, Justice Antonin Scalia said this, very important to understand about Heller and what the Second Amendment means to this day. He said the Second Amendment is not a right. It is not a right to keep and carry any weapon whatsoever in any manner whatsoever and for whatever purpose. This again coming from the pen of Antonin Scalia. He went on to say nothing in our opinion, finding again for the first time that there is this right under the Second Amendment, nothing in our opinion casts doubt on long-standing prohibitions on the possession of firearms by felons and the mentally ill, or laws forbidding the carrying of firearms in sensitive places like schools and government buildings, or laws imposing conditions and qualifications on the commercial sale of arms. Hugely significant language because it says that the right to possess weapons inside the home, to use them for defensive purposes, is not unlimited. Nothing in our opinion should restrict the capacity of government to impose reasonable restrictions, controls, limits on the use, the possession of weapons that are appropriate to preserve our safety and security. Something hugely overlooked by many Americans when they think that today, based upon Heller, the Supreme Court said that you've got this unfettered, unqualified right to own, possess, use weapons. Simply not true. And significantly, in the next case the Supreme Court decided just last June, that language, that not just qualifying, but law-establishing language in Heller was repeated for the benefit of all Americans who have to understand the Second Amendment is not this unqualified right to own, use, carry, possess weapons in all circumstances, under all places and all times. We're going to get back to the kinds of things that using that language in Heller, the governments of our local, our state, and our federal institutions can in fact enforce to ensure that we're safe and secure even under the prescriptions of Heller, establishing again under the Second Amendment this right to possess weapons in the home for defensive purposes. So that's been the law. That's been the law for 15 years. Heller has been the law in America. What happened? What happened just last year? The second major case we're talking about this morning in connection with our review of major things that have happened before the United States Supreme Court that impact our lives to this day. The second case in June of 2022. yes, that's right, just 8 months or so ago, a case called New York State Rifle and Pistol Association versus Kevin Bruen, B-R-U-E-N, often referred to now as the Bruen case. So we have Heller back in 2008 and then Bruen in 2022. What does this particular case say and how does it come about? Well, this case comes about not out of the District of Columbia, but rather out of the state of New York. And for centuries, at least more than one century, the Sullivan Act in the state of New York vested in local law enforcement, gave local law enforcement the discretionary judgment to grant concealed carry authorizations or permits to citizen applicants. In other words, the law required in the state of New York that in order to carry a weapon in public, again, outside the home, in places of community, in places of public gathering, the local law enforcement authorities could ask the question on the application, what makes you special? Why should we grant you this special right to carry weapons, concealed carry, also open carry, opens the door to that as well. What makes it appropriate for us to grant you this special permission to carry guns in public? The law basically required, as it said, a demonstration of a special need for self-protection distinguishable, different from that of the general community or persons engaged in the same profession. In other words, a clearly stated non-speculative need for self-defense in the public domain. You put together an application. You say, I want a weapon in the state of New York, and I have to describe in a paragraph, maybe some sentences, why it is that my particular situation, maybe because of where I live, maybe because of where I travel, maybe because of the job that I do, I need a defensive weapon in the public domain beyond the home established in Heller. That's what the New York law said. And the case comes about when there's a challenge to that particular law. New York's proper cause standard, this process that I just described, is challenged by Kevin Bruen and others who say, you know what? That also infringes upon my Second Amendment right to carry weapons where? Not just inside the home for self-defensive purposes. That's Heller back in 2008. But I'm going to see if I can expand this now into the public domain for maybe to engage in the possession, the carrying of weapons in the public domain. And Kevin Bruen comes before the courts and says the Supreme Court and other courts below the Supreme Court should advance the notion that the Second Amendment, again, passed way back in the 18th century, also contemplated by its language and, yes, indeed, its history, keep that in mind, the history of the Second Amendment ever since its passage, also contemplates the possibility of carrying weapons in the public domain, existing outside of the home as well. Justice Clarence Thomas, writing for the majority of the court, expressed concerns about what he saw as the objective role of the New York State officials in deciding whether one person as opposed to another could carry concealed weapons, and that led to his writing the majority decision in Bruen. Right after this break, we're going to tell you about what Bruen said, what it doesn't say, and why, once again, it is so important to understand this in 21st century America. Stay with us for that and more.
When it's raining cats and dogs, your business can rain profits. Sponsoring the weather forecasts on your local Civic Media station will get your phone to ring.
Listeners pay attention to weather forecasts, and they'll pay attention to your message.
Act now, because we're slashing prices up to 50% on these premium sponsorships.
But the deals absolutely end March 15th.
Log on to civicmedia.us/weather now. That's civicmedia.us/weather. Sponsoring our forecasts is the Cats Meow.
I was just curious as to why you called it the Paul Revere Show.
The Paul Revere Show is named this way because the poem that we all know, the famous ride, the poem was written to rally the troops to fight slavery and fight for democracy. And so I named the show the Paul Revere Show because I thought it was the time to get on the air and talk about democracy.
The Paul Revere Show with Mark Thompson. Listen Monday, 7 to 8 p.m., always on the Civic Media app.
Look through your children's eyes, and you will discover the true magic of a forest.
Find a forest near you and start exploring at discovertheforest.org. Brought to you by the United States Forest Service and the Ad Council.
Did you know your favorite shows and hosts are active on social media too? Find Civic Media on Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook and be part of the conversation happening there. And go to our website, civicmedia.us, to learn more about the Civic Media Network.
Here's your updated forecast. Cloudy skies expected this afternoon, with daytime highs approaching 45. Winds out of the west, 20 to 25 miles per hour. Lows level off around 23. Tonight, overcast skies. Overcast again tomorrow. Snow likely. Highs level off around 26. 2 to 4 inches of snow tomorrow through tomorrow night. For Civic Media, I'm meteorologist Paul Trombley on 98.3 FM and 1100 AM WISS. Right now, 38.
Push our button, and we might just push yours. Civic Media.
This is our final segment of the first hour, only the first hour, here on our weekly review, our analysis of law, government, and justice in America, spending some time this hour and next hour, and yes, once again, next Saturday, talking about the United States Supreme Court. For the break, talking about this major case, Bruin, decided just last June 2022, an opinion authored by Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas for a majority of the Supreme Court, who said once again, for the first time in our nation's history, the constitutional right to bear arms in public for self-defense, the Supreme Court said, is not a second-class right subject to an entirely different body of rules than the other Bill of Rights guarantees that do not require individuals to demonstrate to government officers some special need. Again, identifying this special need application of the New York law. That's the word of the Supreme Court in June of last year. The Second Amendment right to carry arms in public for self-defense is no different from those other rights and is supported by, here we go, history. History. That is the key not only to the case that the Supreme Court decided in 2008, way back then in the case called Heller, but in a major way reaffirmed in the Bruin case a focus upon history. And in particular, in this case, again, deciding on the legitimacy, striking down the legitimacy of the New York law, the Supreme Court said nothing in the Second Amendment text draws a home public distinction. In other words, what we decided in Heller should also apply here in Bruin, brings that concept out into the streets of America. With respect to the right to keep and bear arms, the definition of bear naturally encompasses public carry. Those are the words of the United States Supreme Court. Went on to say, the Constitution guarantees an individual right to possess and carry weapons in cases of confrontation, and confrontation can surely take place outside the home. All of that by the United States Supreme Court in June of last year, again expanding dramatically the role of the Second Amendment and its breadth outside the home. Now, significantly, as I said before, inside that majority opinion and written by Chief Justice Roberts and also affirmed by Justice Kavanaugh was a reaffirmation of that wonderful language in Heller that said that the government still can impose conditions and restrictions and limits on this use. And again, those two justices agreed with the general result. They're among the majority, but noted the distinction between discretionary sort of may-issue licensing regimes like that in New York and so-called shall-issue state processes that required the completion of various administrative thresholds, including trainings and fees. And that distinction between the may-issue and the shall-issue states is also significant for understanding the breadth of the decision in Bruin. But most importantly, again, inside this majority opinion, inside the concurrences, the notion, once again, articulated by Justice Scalia in 2008, that permits governments to impose a variety of rational and reasonable restrictions on things like the manufacture, the transport, the sale, the possession, the carry, and the use of arms, none of that limited by Bruin, even though, once again, it expands dramatically what our Supreme Court understands the Second Amendment to be all about. Now, needless to say, huge, virulent dissent by many members of the Supreme Court, unfortunately not in the majority. Stephen Breyer was perhaps the one who articulated most strongly his disagreement with the majority opinion. He said, first, the court made its decision based on insufficient evidence, deciding the case without any factual development,
didn't allow the parties to develop the legal process of discovering evidence, which would allow the court to see the actual impact of the legislation that was being attacked in the state of New York. A very important point. He goes on to say, the majority's new test of Second Amendment history, this focus on going back and saying whether or not there was a foundation in history, as the Supreme Court, the majority said, and Justice Thomas in particular wrote, a vestige from the past. That basically, that refusal to consider the government's interests in keeping us safe and secure to justify a challenged gun regulation, that can't be right, Breyer says. The dissenting justice and others believe that balancing lawful use of firearms against the potential dangers of that right is a job for the legislative branch, and the Second Amendment should not prevent democratically elected officials from enacting laws to address a serious problem of gun violence. Once again, affirming the notion that Congress and state legislatures can, in fact, do things, and that along the way, the courts should not be focused with this razor-sharp focus on history. And finally, he really hones in on that notion. He says that Thomas's interpretation of this history, that the majority found to be conclusive, that is, looking backwards and not focusing upon the impact of guns in America today, addresses no realistic problem. Goes on to say that history is only one of the tools that the court possesses, and the majority's reliance on exclusively to find that indeed the Second Amendment does in fact protect open carry, concealed carry in the streets of America, that can't be. And again, this notion of history, something we've seen in the court in other cases involving other legislative reviews, takes a fine point when Justice Breyer says this: I fear that it will often prove difficult to identify analogous technological and social problems from medieval England, he says, the founding era, or the time period in which the 14th Amendment was ratified. Again, he is making a very serious point, but somewhat tongue-in-cheek, saying you can't possibly identify today legislation and ways of living in America today that you would have foundations in back in history. He says laws addressing repeating crossbows, lance gays, dirks, dags, skeins, stiletters, and other ancient weapons will be of little help to courts confronting modern problems. And again, most importantly, he says, along with other Supreme Court justices Elena Kagan and Justice Sotomayor, both of them also join in this strong dissent. He says, you know what? It is very appropriate for courts to take a look at the reasons why the Supreme Court is doing what it's doing. Very important to determine whether or not there's a legitimate government interest in enacting these laws, and that's all about safety and security. So it takes this very strong, strong position in opposition to what has happened in the majority opinion. And to that end, again, Justice Kagan, Justice Sotomayor say this: the history, actually, if you look at it, if you do in fact focus on it, seems to establish a robust tradition of regulations restricting the public carriage of concealed firearms. So, again, adopting the Supreme Court's view, to the extent that any uncertainty remains, that uncertainty counsels against relying on history alone. They go on to say it is appropriate to look beyond the history and engage in what the court calls means and scrutiny. Courts must be permitted to consider the state's interest in preventing gun violence. It makes perfect sense, right? The effectiveness of the contested law in achieving that interest, what the connection is between what you're doing and what you're hoping to accomplish, and the degree to which the law burdens the Second Amendment right, and if appropriate, any less restrictive alternatives. All of those kinds of things articulated by the dissents in Bruin. When we come back for our second hour, some things that we can think about in the wake of Bruin, in the wake of Heller, that should in fact be on the desks of every legislator in America. Stay with us for that second hour discussion coming up right after this break.
Hear that? If you own a business, that's a problem. What you really need is this. If you want to make your phone ring this spring, we have just the thing.
Sponsor weather forecasts on your local Civic Media station.
We've slashed prices on our premium weather sponsorships up to 50%. Tie your business message and phone number into our hourly weather forecasts and get results. But you must hurry.
This spectacular offer ends March 15th.
Log on to civicmedia.us/weather now. That's civicmedia.us/weather.
Hey, this is Jim Santel. I am the host of Morning Cannolis every single Saturday morning from 9 a.m. to 11 a.m.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay.
WGBW 1590 AM Denmark. W250 CV Green Bay.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.